nation, and they bonded in the worship of a dead man on a cross. They sought control of the common people by demanding allegiance to the Church of Rome. And the Pope declared the Inquisition. It was a war against the women whose power they feared. In this Holocaust against the nature people, and the tale is told of those who by the hundreds, holding together, chose their death in the sea, while chanting the praises of the Mother Goddess, a refusal of betrayal, women were dying to be free.
And you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. Stand by now for APA Compass.
The Creative Music Guild, Merrillhurst University, and KBOO Community Radio are proud sponsors of a weekend residency by Mark Rabeau, May 8th and 9th at Merrillhurst University. Renowned guitarist and composer Mark Rabeau will perform a solo concert on Friday, May 8th at 8 p.m., and will lead a workshop on group free improvisation on Saturday, May 9th from 2 to 5. The workshop is open to musicians of any experience level, and all instruments are welcome. Both events are taking place at the St. Anne's Church on the Merrillhurst campus, 17600 Pacific Highway, which is Highway 43. More information about the May 8th and 9th events featuring Mark Rabeau can be found on kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under community events.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership director. I want to thank you for being a member and a listener to KBOO. I also wanted to share this listener's comment on why they support KBOO.
Long live the underground. Charles from Portland, Oregon.
We hope that you feel the same. Please support your community and your local radio station by going to kboo.fm/give.
Hmong, Nepalian, Indonesian, Nian, Filipina, Malaysian, Pakistani, Taiwanese, Cambodian, Korean, Hapa, Laotian, Samoan, Bangladeshi, Thai, Singaporean, Chinese, Indian, Hawaiian, Japanese, Sri Lankan, Vietnamese.
KBOO's Asian Pacific American Collective is proud to announce the premiere of APA Compass, a monthly public affairs program.
Bringing to the airwaves our diverse voices and shared commitment to economic, political, and social justice.
On our first program, we will tackle recent incidents of anti-Asian racism on corporate radio.
Tune in Friday afternoon, May 27th at 12:30 for APA Compass.
Your Asian Pacific American orientation.
Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to this very special episode of APA Compass right here on KBOO Community Radio. That, what you were just listening to, was the promo to advertise the show back in May of 2005, 10 years ago. So this month marks our 10th anniversary, 10 years of the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio show, bringing you news, features, interviews, angry APA minutes, voices from our diverse community. And sadly, this is also our last episode. We're getting what I'm calling a makeover and will be called Intersections, which will still air at 9 a.m. on the first Fridays, but we'll talk more about that in a bit. So 10 years and a farewell, and we're celebrating in style. In studio, we have Tony Tabora Roberts, who joined the collective in 2007?
Around 2007, I
Hello,
think.
Good morning, Tony. We have Marie Lowe, who is a founding member from 2005.
Hi.
Good morning, Marie.
Good morning.
And then on the phone, we have Patty Sakurai, who's joining us from her office in Corvallis. No, we don't have Patty just yet. She'll be joining us in a bit. She's also a founding member. And, well, working hard behind the scenes in our air room is Liz Rogers, who is also a founding member, and she's engineering. I don't think she's going to talk in the mic right now, but I'll bug her about it in a bit. I'm Sarika Mehta. I'm actually the newest member to the collective. I joined after moving here to Portland in 2010. So from what I understand, from what the rumors have told me around the KBOO sphere, APA Compass was really put on the map after, or that is to say to the KBOO listener world, from an interview with a rather famous comedian by the name of Margaret Cho. And we can hear that clip now.
To show. She kind of looks like Connie Chung, but in her own slutty way. It's Margaret Chung.
I think most of us have carried the burden of having an assumed representation of all Asian Americans. You being who you are and having such a broad platform and spotlight, and obviously that representation is assumed on you. How does that affect basically what you say and how you say it, knowing that you're automatically representing a whole group of people?
Well, it's really weird. What's strange is, like, I've noticed it now more than ever, and on this book tour especially. Like, I go to these different shows to promote my book, and the host is very nice, and he says, well, I love the book, and just tell me, what was it like to make Charlie's Angels? I see how people try to be funny and cute, but it's not funny. But there's this weird permission that people have to make jokes about Asian Americans. Asian Americans mm-hmm. somehow retain a kind of foreigner identity, and I'm not sure why. And it doesn't work, that excuse, like, well, we look different. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mm-hmm. work on me anymore, because that's not enough. You know, it's not mm-hmm. enough to make it okay.
And maybe just to follow up on that, the assumption that Asian Americans are also passive, mm-hmm. quiet, and for Asian American women in particular, the kind of geisha subservient, mm-hmm. you know, docile, passive stereotype that for Asian American women in particular, I think sometimes it's hard to fight against all those kinds of expectations. So what inspires you to get up in the morning and say these things that sometimes people are not really interested or ready to hear?
Well, in dealing with that invisibility, what motivates me is speaking with other people who also recognize that invisibility in their lives. And this extends past Asian American and also ethnic minority experience. It goes into the gay and lesbian community, and it goes even further. Like, it's a very strange thing. Invisibility is so hard to explain also to people who are not invisible and have never had that experience and don't know what you would be talking about at all. And they say, well, why are you so upset? Jackie Chan is a really big star. And mm-hmm. it's good that I chose the field that I'm in, which is stand-up comedy, because it's a place where anger is really allowed, that anger and this aggressive voice is actually welcomed, and it's a better format for that. And it's a good place for me to be as an artist because it suits my temperament and my situation. Mm-hmm. But it can be really trying. So I guess what keeps me going is just that communication with other people who experience the same thing. And also the amazement that I feel whenever I do bring this up with, say, a straight white male person who may be speaking with me, and they have the most amazing answers that I can't believe. Like, I was talking to this guy about it, you know, on a radio show, and then he just said, well, don't you think Asians just don't want to be in entertainment? And he felt completely comfortable saying that. And nobody around has ever even blinked like that was a racist statement, or even if it was insensitive at all. He just was making an observation, as a straight white man would. I just don't think Asians want to do this because I don't see any. Mm-hmm. And they look at the world in a very different way than we do. I mean, I talk about in my book why I would really love to be a straight white man just for a weekend, because I think it would be so relaxing. Because they think so simply about things. They don't have to really have all of that cultural baggage and the racial baggage that we do. So it's very odd where you realize that, oh my God, the world that I live in is so ignorant, and they don't even care that they're ignorant. They don't even want it to be pointed out. They don't care to learn it because they just never, ever thought anything they did was wrong. I think sometimes I get very tired of it. I mean, I get so sick of trying to teach white people about racism. I think, why is this my job? If our schools did a better job, if we had more of an understanding of other cultures, if we didn't deny so much of our own racist history, then I think things would be better. And why am I left to do this job that should have been done by our teachers in our schools?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How would you describe your relationship with the Asian American community?
Well, my relationship with the Asian American community is interesting. It's changed. When I first came about doing my sitcom All American Girl, I think that my appearance was very shocking to people, because here the network was trying to appeal to the Asian American community and say, here's this young girl that's doing this, and she's like one of you. And yet I think that I was really rejected a lot by older Asian Americans, because the sudden appearance of this, like, okay, here's somebody that's supposed to be representing you, was just so unwarranted and uninvited and kind of, you know, very shocking. I think what the problem was doing television was that because the network was so concerned about the fact that this was an Asian American family, and they thought that the Asian faces on a show would be so shocking to middle America, that they had to make the writing, the content of the show, as mediocre as possible. So the show didn't work because we weren't allowed to be ourselves at all. And we were so focused on this idea of ethnicity and defining that ethnicity that it was a failure, because you can't really define ethnicity and have that be the only trait of somebody's personality. But I think that's what has happened a lot to Asian actors in the mainstream. You know, if you watch a television show and there's an Asian actor featured in it, most likely their ethnicity has so much to do with their storyline and their what they're doing and their role in the show, that they just become just a race, not a character with feelings that have, they have interaction. I mean, like, okay, I like the show Lost mm-hmm. a lot. And I like the Korean people on that show because I think they're very real. Mm-hmm. I think they're very, very authentic. However, their purpose on that show is really just to be Korean. Most of the characters that you see on anything, in any film or television show, their ethnicity has so much to do with them that why don't you just have like a map of the country or something? Because it's a very... I think insulting way to deal with trying to make the television world or the film world look like the world as it is. Mm-hmm. So, but getting back to my relationship with the Korean community, it was very difficult for me in the beginning, because I had to kind of negotiate through all of these feelings people had. And nowadays, my relationship is actually very, very interesting. I mean, it's great, because a lot of kids grew up with me and watched me on television and were very excited, because I was like talking and relating an experience that they had, that they understood. Like when I talked about my mom, they had the same mom. You know, they had the same kind of incredible like embarrassment at having this very foreign mother and having to deal with that. And, you know, talking about that was very cathartic for them too. So we have the whole generation that's grown up with my work. And so I have a great amount of respect there too. And I think that the older generation is also catching up with that and sort of realizing that, you know, my impact on the community has been pretty big. And so it's great now, you know, I've reached this sort of elder statesman status, but it's a cool thing. It was very hard in the beginning. And I think it was harder because I'm a woman. They didn't see a man up there going first. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they didn't have like some pro golfer or whatever, I'm sure, which they would really love, but it was just me. So, you know, I was not the best representation of their culture. So that was then, but now things are much improved.
Margaret, Margaret, here she comes. She's doing the star dance for everyone. She's kind of wild and crazy too, but everybody loves who? It's Margaret Cho.
Well, that was our interview with Margaret Cho back in 2005, I think, November 2005.
And so let's just jump right into it. Marie, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, it's definitely really interesting and certainly brings up a lot of memories in thinking about this particular program and the fact that that was about 10 years ago. Well, you know, we heard that Margaret Cho was coming into town, and we thought, wouldn't it be really neat if we contacted her? And it was totally a pie in the sky kind of an idea, because of course she's Margaret Cho. But Liz, she somehow managed to get in touch, and then lo and behold, Margaret came to the KBOO station. And I have to say, we were all very starstruck and in awe. And she was so down to earth and really nice. And it was a really great opportunity to just hear about, you know, her work, but also, of course, the fact that she made it an effort to reach out to community radio stations, to, collectives such as ours, and made sure that, you know, we were able to actually connect. And also she, you know, obviously was there to support programs such as ours. So it was really a fantastic moment.
Oh, Tony, did you want to add something? All right, then. Well, do we have Patty on the line here?
Yep, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Patty, yeah. Welcome from Corvallis. Do you have any memories you want to share from that feature?
I guess just to echo what Marie was saying, I think especially since it happened so early on, again, I think it was also new to us and just kind of awestruck by the fact that, oh my goodness. And I think, my only recollection, it was my first duties of engineering and being responsible for the recording, and I just remember my heart beating the whole time. I'm like, just please don't let me mess up. Please don't let me mess up. Again, I think just the idea of access and being able to have, just the interview and the type of things that she was talking about, and the power of being part of a collective. It was just, was very exciting.
And if I could add, too, I mean, you know, what Patty is just saying, that sort of being the power of, or the power of a collective and being a part of that, I think that, you know, some of the things that she was talking about in terms of Asian American invisibility, I think that that is actually still obviously an ongoing issue. And it's interesting to think that her show, All American Girl, that she talks about in that segment, first aired in 1994. And, you know, the kinds of issues that she faced in producing the show, which was, you know, the first situational comedy that featured an Asian American family, an Asian American cast. That was, you know, an amazing landmark moment. And I know for myself personally, when I heard about this show coming on, I was so thrilled and glued to the TV and, you know, ready to watch it. And then, of course, there was that disconnect between my expectations and my hopes for the show and then the reality. And I think she really talked a lot about the reality of, you know, Hollywood, the entertainment industry, their expectations, the kinds of stereotypes that the show sadly, because, you know, was kind of wrestled out of Margaret's control, that the show reproduced in some ways.
Yeah, and I guess, and this is Patty again, I guess to add to that, I think what's striking to me is, you know, then questions about how much things have changed. Marie had mentioned, you know, it's still so relevant. And for me, I can't not think of Fresh Off the Boat,
right,
Eddie Wong's
absolutely.
Show, right?
Yes.
And I think, you know, the media coverage and the kind of discussion and excitement and criticism and da-da-da, I just feel like, wow, it's like it's how long has passed since All American Girl, and here we are so many years later, and in some ways having the same conversations, right? Eddie Wong, I was just watching a piece, an interview he did, he's saying, look, still, this is just, you know, tip of the iceberg. It's one drop, and it's sad that this is like the only show. And we had to wait this long before we cut another show.
Yeah, so only 20 years.
So
much
pressure, right? Exactly.
And so then so much pressure and expectation is on that one show, and it's just impossible for that show to accurately, you know, be able to represent so many different, you know, aspects of Asian Pacific American experiences. And I think, again, all the more why having a show like APA Compass and trying to cast as wide a net as we could and never trying to pretend we could have any kind of single representation.
Right.
I mean, the whole point is there's no such thing.
Of course. Tony, I think you're on now. Did you want to add
something? Oh, yeah. No, I think you guys pretty much covered it. I think, it is, interestingly, the same similar conversation, but I do think things have moved forward, and also with the age of a lot more conversation on the internet,
right.
I think the conversation moves more quickly, hopefully, and we can hopefully get further faster.
You think? Yeah. Yeah, hopefully things will move and forward a little bit faster. Just a little bit.
Just tiny.
Trying to have some patience here.
A nanosecond faster.
So another very popular feature of our show is the Angry APA Minute. And I was always under the... Okay, so I joined 5 years into this show, and I was always under the impression that it was not necessarily 60 seconds of anger, but more like, have you got a minute? I have to get something off my chest. But actually, the earlier versions were like between 60 and 90 seconds, which is short and concise and impressive to, you know, put out a commentary like that. We actually have a couple of Angry APA Minutes from previous collective members that we want to share for you, and you might even recognize these voices. So let's take a listen in a moment.
Oh, I think we're having some technical
I think we're having some technical difficulties.
It's time for Angry Asian Minute. This month's Angry Asian Minute is by Jay Sablon, a mixed-race Saipanese Chamorro genderqueer student and community activist. This Angry Asian Minute is titled, Everyone Asks the Question, No One Wants to Hear the Answers.
Everyone seems to ask, what are you? I'm a male to female to other and everything in between, gender non-identified queer, a Palawana, a Florita, with a hint of Catholic guilt. In other circles, I'm a Pacific Islander from Saipan, the island nation no one has ever heard of, and if they have, it is usually associated with World War II, or happy, happy natives for the tourists, or news reports of sweatshop labor exploitation, as if my indigenous Chamorro culture and people have solely become these static images, as if over 300 years of colonization by Spaniards and Germans and Japanese and Americans have been eradicated, as if we do not have a present or future, and yet still, I'm the ambiguously super intelligent sort of Asian, both liberated and swallowed whole by the term Asian Pacific Islander, who doesn't cause trouble, has succeeded in assimilating into whiteness with or without a hyphen to separate my ethnic identity from the word American, who isn't a part of the dialogue about race because race in this nation is still about being black or white. What are you, you ask? I'm from the U.S. Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. I'm as American as apple pie.
Well, I don't know if you recognize that voice, but that was collective member Jay Sablon from, I want to say, 2005, 2006.
Yep.
You, Tony and Marie and Patty, all three of you, I think, knew Jay back in the day. So why don't you talk a little bit about the Angry APA Minute concept as well as Jay's?
I think the Angry APA Minute, it comes out of this reaction to the model minority kind of stereotype of us being very Asian Americans being very subservient or
passive and quiet.
And it also sort of a legacy of a blogger named Angry Asian Man. And there was a comic, which I think we covered recently on APA Compass, Angry Little Asian Girl, which also had that same sort of reaction to the stereotypes, and an effort to also be able to include community voices beyond the collective.
Right. And definitely it was a chance for us to it was a chance for people to share their stories, but we also tried to help people with the editing process as well. So it was a chance for people to learn some editing skills, radio production skills, and that was part of the sort of goal about, you know, giving people more access to tools and opportunities to have their voice heard. So that was also part of the goal behind having an Angry APA Minute, where people from the community could come on air and share their perspectives and stories. And I wanted to reiterate what Tony just said about, you know, the particular idea of being angry, which is a response to this kind of docile, passive, stereotype of APAs. And also to talk about anger as a kind of mobilizing strategy, that it's not just, you know, especially I feel like this is very relevant in light of what's going on in Baltimore and thinking about the terms that we use to describe what's going on in terms of riot versus uprising versus protest. And I think that those all register different ideas of anger. But, you know, what we wanted to highlight was that anger was actually a very powerful mobilizing force, and that it's not simply irrational, chaotic sort of expressions of, you know, frustration, but that there was actually reason, there was a critique behind it, and there were, you know, important mobilizing opportunities behind anger.
Oh, absolutely. Did either of you two ever have an angry APA minute with this show over the past 10 years that you remember?
Oh, yeah.
I think I did. Maybe I think that's a kind of the hazing. I mean, initiation for
exactly
doing
say.
for getting to be part of the collective.
I think I got lucky, because the Angry AP Minute was actually something that made me very nervous to produce and put out there, because it was my voice and it was my anger, and like you were saying, that I was very afraid of the reaction, you know, from listeners or from people that I know or whatever when I did my first. But luckily, I was able to get away with doing an interview before I did an Angry AP Minute. It took me a while, actually, to get my angry minutes out there. Is it a couple? Do you guys remember what you talked about in your Angry AP minutes?
Wow. Goodness.
Now you're like an embarrassed.
See, I'm embarrassed because mine's not quite 10 years ago. Mine would have been like half that. But
that's all right.
But I don't remember what I did. I think what the interesting thing also about the Angry APA Minute was, a lot of times they were reactions to things that were happening in the moment. And it was a way to get something off our chest. And so I don't remember what it was at the time, but I know it was probably something in the news. Mm-hmm. It was probably some controversy that was
I think if I recall, gosh, this is why it's embarrassing, because my brain is a sieve these days, but I think I talked about accents and the ways in which certain accents are coded culturally, why certain accents are presumed to be more intelligent, authoritative, quote-unquote easy to understand versus other kinds of accents, which of course in particular certain immigrant accents. So I think that was what my APA Angry APA Minute was about, and especially, of course, in light of radio and the primacy of voice in this medium. So
thank you for talking about that. So besides the Angry APA Minutes, and we have more to share with you in this hour, another amazing feature that I came to discover as we were uncovering our vault of archives was a segment regarding Hurricane Katrina. It was from the early years of the show, obviously. This was a feature by collective member Pam Pham. And it was assembled by other collective members, and this was, as I said, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, specifically the displacement of APA communities in New Orleans and the complete lack of outreach. So the feature itself was about 13 minutes, but I took this very short clip, selfishly, because I'm an interpreter, and she was talking about the lack of interpreting services. And also, this talked about communities of color coming together. So let's have a listen to this clip.
Tony Nguyen comments on the specific issue of interpreters in Bayou La Batra.
FEMA had a few different bilingual translators. I overheard the Vietnamese translator, and her Vietnamese wasn't that good. I could see that she wasn't that competent.
Oh Nguyen, a volunteer with the Resource Action Group, had similar observations.
They do not have enough interpreters available, and when they do, it seems like the question...
Tony Nguyen comments on the specific issue of interpreters in Bayou La Batra.
FEMA had a few different bilingual translators. I overheard the Vietnamese translator, and her Vietnamese wasn't that good. I could see that she wasn't that competent.
Oh Nguyen, a volunteer with the Resource Action Group, had similar observations.
They do not have enough interpreters available, and when they do, it seems like the questions are answered incorrectly. And also, FEMA doesn't seem to have a category for Vietnamese speakers. Even with the Vietnamese interpreters that are from the community, that are working for FEMA, on top of their application, it would state that they are Spanish-speaking. And these are the Vietnamese interpreters whose homes have been devastated, and they're working for FEMA, so it doesn't seem like FEMA recognizes the Asian community down here.
Daryl Jordan offers these final thoughts.
Well, in some ways, I think that it gives a lot of activists and organizers in communities of color the opportunity to start afresh trying to build new and different kinds of relationships with each other as we begin to redefine what our communities can be and what our relationships to each other can be, and so that maybe we can begin to figure out what some of the real issues are and who the real enemies are, and that we can stop fussing, fighting, and struggling with each other over little resources that weren't meant for us in the first place, and figure out how we work together to make sure that we do get the kind of resources that we need to develop our communities.
How long do we have? Oh, hi. Well, that was the piece on Hurricane Katrina, at least a one short segment of it. I think Patty and Marie, were you involved in the production of this piece? Because Pam is not here.
So. Yeah, well, I think we were. and you know, this is actually a part of the collective process where we actually all worked on parts of it together. So we really try to avoid a sense of, you know, ownership or singular individual ownership of a particular piece. So someone might conduct the interview, someone else might do the preliminary edit, and then we collectively get together and listen to it and then re-edit together as a group. And so, yeah, most likely I was involved, but I have to say that, you know, specifically the details, I don't completely remember.
Patty, do you have anything you want to add?
This is Patty? I'm sorry.
Yes, did you want to add anything?
Oh, yeah, I guess, you know, as I remember, you know, again, I think as Marie was saying, just a lot of work went into, you know, this piece and a lot of different pieces behind the scenes. So we would divvy up, do transcription. I think we put in quite a bit of research, not necessarily in this clip, it's not as evident, but trying to look at the history of Asian immigrants in the area that just, again, gets so overlooked, and particularly in this case, looking at Vietnamese American populations. And I think, you know, in some ways it wasn't by design, but it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition with the Margaret Cho piece. Mm-hmm. And I think thinking about, you know, this piece, I think it was really when it hit me. This was our original idea when we put together the proposal, and I think the motivating factor for so many of us in the collective, and really I don't want to speak for the collective, but I think all of us, you know, Margaret Cho, by all means, the issues she was speaking of don't get a whole lot of airtime, but Margaret Cho herself as a celebrity
right.
certainly mm-hmm. gets attention, and I think the contrast between this, I mean, we were looking at the post-Katrina, you know, coverage, and there was just nothing, you know, and no discussion, and it's by all means the media coverage in general, I think, is right. worthy of quite a bit of criticism.
Yes.
But the fact that there was just no acknowledgement whatsoever of these populations and kind of thinking about, you know, what our program was dedicating ourselves to doing, and I think just really appreciative of what it meant, and I think, you know, the fact that none of us had radio experience heading into this, so it was a lot of trial and error, but the fact that KBOO took a chance right, with mm-hmm. us, and in terms of as a collective, you know, again, just really appreciative and didn't want to, you know, by all means take the opportunity for granted. It was really, again, as the only APA public affairs show for a long in the Northwest, I think it really struck me as kind of, yeah, again, just really grateful for the opportunity.
Yeah, I wasn't there for that piece, but you know what Patty's saying about just being able to give voice to people who don't ever get to be on the radio, and I actually remember helping record someone from the Cambodian American community. It was more of an oral history, just them speaking about their experience. It was just, for me, just being in the room while they were recording, it was very moving, and I'm sure for the listener eventually who got to hear that. But so I think it was, this program just served that purpose, but also behind the scenes, just, you know, what Marie's talking about, being able to work as a collective and teach each other how to use these tools, and working side by side and saying, here, this is how you edit, you know, that little breath out.
Here's how you add music.
And here's how you add music, you know, and really working side by side together with folks. It was really a great experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really empowering, I would say. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I've definitely had the opportunity to put together some amazing pieces, like with amazing people, the pieces themselves, you know, you tell me, but with amazing people. And I know what you're saying about the behind the scenes, Tony, where you record something and it's raw, and you know, you're it's so emotional sometimes, or it's just very inspiring. And and that was one of the most exciting aspects of being a part of this collective. And I just want to take this opportunity right now to tell all of KBOO, to tell the whole station, we are so grateful that you took a chance on us and you believed in us and you've trained us, because from what I understand, again, I joined late. from what I heard, that nobody had any radio production experience at all. It was Patty was saying that I guess this Hurricane Katrina story was one of the reasons that that this collective happened, or the motivation behind the collective,
or it affirmed sort of like, you know, the mission of APA Compass and why we came together was to produce these kinds of stories and to highlight these kinds of experiences and needs and of different communities, also beyond Pacific Northwest. I mean, mm-hmm. we really were also focused on looking at communities outside of the region, and to think about sort of, well, cross-regional solidarity. And, you know, one of the reasons why we were able to connect with people on the ground doing relief work in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina was because we had connections. Pam actually knew people who had gone over to New Orleans to help. And so it was also about that kind of network building and community building that was beyond simply, you know, the specific region, and to think about how our experiences in the Pacific Northwest connect to people outside of this area.
Exactly. And we have another feature to share with you all. It's kind of an audio postcard from our very own Liz Rogers, who is working very hard behind the scenes. If you haven't noticed, we're experiencing some technical difficulties today, as is what happens in a farewell party. So Liz is working hard, but she produced a lot of brilliant pieces for this show ever since her first days as a founding member. And here's her piece talking about, from what I understand, Before My Days of Portland, a ballot measure that was threatening some language policy issues in our locale. So go ahead.
Earlier, I had a chance to talk to a few people about their perspectives and experiences around language, the role it plays in their identity, speaking with accents, and their thoughts on English only.
I speak Hmong and English.
I speak Somali, English, and some Arabic.
I speak Vietnamese and English.
Like I said, I speak two, but I speak more one and a half, because the dialect of Samoan I speak is more of a slang and not actually a proper Samoan dialect.
My first language is English, and I struggled as an adult to learn my heritage language, which is Spanish.
Well, because language is connected directly to one's culture, to deny somebody their language is denying their identity.
Language is powerful. Words are powerful.
As someone who's adopted and lost their language, I feel like, you know, part of my identity of being East Indian is taken from me.
I work at a high school in Portland, and I do see that students who participate in the ELL program, which is students who aren't, or English is a second language to them, and so I've seen how the interaction with other students, because of their lack of English speaking skills, they're treated in a different way.
The thing is that immigrant refugee struggle is passing through that first phase of having an accent and being then question your ability as a worker or as a community member.
It depends on the roots of the accent too, because people are more comfortable with some accents versus others.
If you have an accent from a Spanish-speaking country, they see you as less able, less smart, less motivated, as not having an accent. Or if somebody had an accent from another language such as French, that seems to be the idea that that person is more exotic. So there is certainly discrimination across accents and language groups as well.
Whether it be in person or over the phone or whatever, if there's like an accent, then people make judgments right away. Just having a little accent could make a difference in what people think.
There is a strong English-only movement, and when we look at our societies globally, I think the United States is one of the few, if not the only, first world countries that has a one language only policy, and that other countries realize that in order to be globally competitive, that we need to have multilingual citizens. So I think that it really is not benefiting us to look so narrowly at our language policies.
English only perspective. The first thing I want to say is, what's wrong with bilingual? I mean, everybody, the waiting lists and all the bilingual programs in Portland are just busting at the seams.
I think that's not realistic, and we, you know, we all came to America for different reasons, and so therefore we bring our culture, and part of our culture is our language.
So when you take away that option to speak your own language, and then you're actually shutting people out. So yeah, I would just say no, I disagree with that.
In the workplace, I think people are surprised when they talk to me over the phone, and then when they see me in person, they're I think taken back a little bit, just because they're expecting, it's almost like they're expecting to see someone else and not me.
All the time they're like, wow, you're from India, but you sound so American.
All right. Well, that is funny. I still hear such comments today. Liz, I know you're working behind the scenes, but do you want to talk a little bit about the piece that you produced?
Yeah, sure.
Well, what year was it, by the way?
Oh, 2008, I think.
2008.
Yeah.
And can you talk about meeting some of the people and how you put together this audio postcard and some of the questions you asked those folks who were a part of that piece?
Yeah, I think it was one of the funner pieces I got to do, to because it just got me out into the community. I went to a different couple of community events, and then just new folks who I thought, you know, would have a valuable voice in the piece, kind of a collage of some different folks with different experiences.
Awesome. And yeah, there were a couple of remarks that really struck me, like, what's wrong with bilingualism? Seriously, we're still saying that. And then another fellow who said, when you take away somebody's language, you're taking away their voice. Those were the, I mean, I still feel like in certain communities, we are still fighting that battle, even if there are a number of dual language programs in Portland public schools with wait lists and all that. It's still, there's still a mentality around, you know, the way we view people who speak or don't speak English as a native language, and their accents and whatnot. Tony, Patty, Marie, do you guys have any comments you want to add?
I think, Marie, you know, the Angry AP minute that you did, that you talked about the accents thing too, I think is very interesting, because I think certain languages and accents are more acceptable or
definitely
than others. So. Yeah.
I thought Marie was going to say something.
Sorry.
Out there. Patty, did you have any comments?
No, I mean, I think, you know, nothing to add to what hasn't already been said. I think thinking about the points, I guess the other thing about the piece, looking at the connection of language and community and identity, I think, too. Yeah, I think definitely, you know, taking away the language and the negative impact that has.
Absolutely. And yeah, and how much is tied into identity exactly, and who has the right to take these things away. I mean, it's a human right. So, which, you know, as I'm in a later piece where we talk about the deaf community fighting in India, we'll get to that a little bit more. Well, as promised, we have more Angry APA Minutes for you. So at this point in the show, we want to honor one of our collective founders, Afifa Ahmed Shafi. She was a community leader who passed away in July of 2013. And additionally, our dear friend and collective member, Andrew Yeh, who is often my own partner in crime when producing this show over the past few years, he and his family moved to Hawaii last year. So both of these members contributed really brilliant Angry APA Minutes on their experiences with identity politics. So let's have a listen.
In Indonesia, in Pakistan, in India, Afghanistan, across the world, people rave about some cartoon printed in Denmark. We're thinking they're so prone to anger, so uncivilized and different from us. They don't appreciate freedom. We have freedom of press. They are so into censorship. I'll tell you what, why are we so angry? Move to riots, violence, even death? Is this about a few lines sketched on Danish newsprint? Is this really about freedom of press?
Or is it just one more finger thrust deep into the wounds of our flesh? Every day, everywhere we look, occupation, invasion, you call it liberation. This is not a clash of civilizations. It is not about freedom. It is about the powerful feasting on the weak and building the structure to keep them weak. I mean, yeah, those cartoons were super racist, but that's not the issue. It's about the injustice that is perpetuating, break, like, and these folks bear the brunt. Andrews, it's our tax dollars that fuel the ammunition. We install their corrupt leaders, and when we're done with them, we take them down. When you see the angry crowds in the paper and on TV, they aren't those angry people over there. Next time you see these folks, think about their grief and ask yourself, are you helping to fuel the source?
My name is Andrew Yeh, and this is my Asian American Activist Minute. This is a story about my daughter. It's a story about how I try to protect my girl and to keep her away from prejudice and discrimination. And then, long before I expected it, racial issues crept into her life, and I had to decide what to do. The incident happened at her friend's birthday party. It's an organized play party at a place with an indoor gym, games, activities, and two super chipper 20-something teachers to lead them. The teachers have the kids singing, dancing, and laughing in no time at all, and the kids just love it. Except for the three kids who are not singing, dancing, or laughing. These three are wallflowers, hanging back, not playing well with the group, and not quite self-confident enough to join in. Somehow, they are different. They are different in behavior and in appearance. They are a Latina girl, a half-Asian, half-Caucasian boy, and my Asian-American daughter. All of the Caucasian kids at the party are comfortably playing with the main group. All of the minority kids are not in that group. Somehow, the kids in the party self-segregated into majority and non-majority groups. How did this happen? Do they even realize that this happened? I should tell you that the kids at this party are 3 years old. 3 years old. Does discrimination start at age three? Maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe it's just a few kids being shy. It could be chance that the three shy kids are exactly the three minority kids. After all, three-year-olds are so innocent, far too young to think about race. I'm Asian, so I do the math. It's 2,000 times more likely that this is a racial than a chance event. I'm not overreacting. It appears that there are racial issues at age three. I do some searching and find lots of interesting research on kids and their racial beliefs. It confirms what I noticed at the birthday party. Almost all kids start noticing racial differences at ages 3 to 4. Some 3-year-olds ignore or avoid kids they perceive to be different. 5-year-olds start developing their ethnic identity. By age 7, kids notice racism directed against their own group. By age 9, racial attitudes are largely established, barring life-changing experiences. The research says that there's this narrow window which starts at age 3 and ends at age 9, which is crucial for developing one's racial attitudes. That's all the time we have. We have 6 years to learn whatever we can about race, and then our racial thought processes are pretty much set for the rest of our lives. Since the clock is ticking for my daughter, I want to actively engage her before this window closes so she can pick up the tools she needs to be racially self-confident. To help her develop tools, we will talk about our cultural background. We will read books featuring people of color. We will spend time with diverse friends. We will attend cultural events of our own and different ethnicities. I will talk to her school about fostering an anti-bias classroom environment. And I will ask of you, talk to your kids about cultural differences and make the world a more accepting place. My name is Andrew Yeh, and this is my Asian American Activist Minute.
So again, that was a shout out to collective member Andrew Yeh, who is, of course, listening from Hawaii, and our friend and founder, Afifa Ahmed Shafi. And we're at the point of the show where it's winding down to the end, as we've featured interviews and Angry APA Minutes and whatnot, and we're transitioning to a new look and a sound and what I call the Extreme Makeover, the audio edition. So APA Compass is going to be called Intersections, and we'll start July 3rd. And that's me hosting and producing. So don't leave me, cable listeners. We're going to look more at what makes up our identities, things like race and gender, race and disability, and that sort. So I had recently visited my family in India, and I had the opportunity to interview a deaf couple who are on the ground as part of this movement fighting for their rights to language, which is something we just talked about in Liz's piece. I had actually produced a longer feature that was aired on KBOO last week, but here's a very short version of that piece on the deaf community in India that is fighting for their language and their rights and for their lives.
India's deaf community is fighting hard for their rights and autonomy. The Indian Sign Language Research and Training Center, the ISLRTC, is an academic institution that promotes the use of Indian Sign Language, deaf culture, and bilingualism for professionals working with deaf children. But more than that, it's a symbol of deaf pride in India and stands as a validation for their language and existence. Since 2007, the community has been fighting to run the center autonomously. However, on April 21st, the Indian government decided the center should be run by the NIHH, the National Institute for the Hearing Handicapped. This is the government agency which focuses on deaf needs, but purely from a medically based rehabilitative model. This decision unexpectedly came yesterday, despite strong objection from the deaf Indian community. But the fight is not over. Following the decision, I spoke with Madan Vasishtha, chief officer of the ISLRTC. For this story, Ramesh Chandrasekharan provided voiceover.
At present, it is planned for April 27th. However, it's a very short time and we may have to postpone by a week or so. It is getting very hot in Delhi and the temperature will hit three digits soon. The National Association of the Deaf leaders are working hard, planning and finding a date. It takes weeks to find a seat in trains, especially now with schools closing. Deaf people coming from Kolkata, Kerala, Chennai and other distant places will have problems. There are a lot of logistics to take care of.
While I was in Mumbai, India in March, I met with Sunil and Shweta Sahasrabuddhe. Both are deaf and fluent signers of Indian Sign Language and proud of their deaf culture. Sunil has been on the ground of the fight, and Shweta gave me insight into the lives of deaf Indians. One of the goals of the ISLRTC is to influence policy decisions in the lives of deaf people, such as the workplace. Shweta describes her struggles as a deaf person at her job.
My boss sent me to training. That was a long, maybe 4 or 5 days.
My boss sent me to a 4 or 5 day training, and I sat through entire lectures that I didn't understand. I didn't understand anything. We need interpreters. Maybe the ISLRTC will force the companies to get them. Maybe ISLRTC will make them understand what deaf people actually need. Then deaf people can enjoy the work environment and share their opinions. They are not dumb. They can share their opinions through sign language, but hearing people don't understand.
This is just one example of why deaf Indians feel so passionately about the Indian Sign Language Research and Training Center. Sunil explains how the ISLRTC can influence policy and perhaps even change the negative perception of deaf people in India.
We're not even able to get 5% of what is shared. It is difficult to live with the hearing world. There is too little information and thinking that...
India's deaf community is...
There is too little information and thinking that hearing people look at us like we are dumb, stupid. We feel depressed. We feel like this is not the way we are. We can be different. But we need to close the communication gap. The ISLRTC will help create awareness so the lives of deaf people will get better.
RTC will create awareness so that the life of the deaf people will get better.
Although the Indian government decided to merge the ISLRTC with the NIHH, the fight is not over.
The fight is just starting. Deaf people in India have been treated worse than slaves, and it is time that the government woke up and followed on UNCRPD, which it has ratified, and RPWD, which is in the parliament now. Again, visit islrtcnow.com. Thank you for all your support.
I know there is a famous quote, one American said this.
There is a famous quote by a deaf American, George Weddes. As long as we have deaf people on earth, we will have signs. In that context, yes, we keep signing and we pass sign language from generation to generation. But in the context of our case, we know that there are 10 million Indian sign language users. But we still feel that if we have the ISLRTC as an autonomous center, it would be perfect, solid proof of our language and culture. So I want to see it set up in 1 to 2 years. Until then, we keep fighting.
Proof, solid proof of our existence, of our language, our culture. So I want to see the ISLRTC to be set up in 1 year or two. Until then, we'll keep fighting.
For KBOON, I'm Sarika Mehta.
Well, that's it for APA Compass. Any other memories from reminiscing from Nostalgia Land, Patty, Marie, and Tony?
I just wanted to say that it was really sad and powerful to hear Afifa's voice,
absolutely.
Sort of living on. So I just wanted to acknowledge and recognize her and all her work, not just for APA Compass, but for, you know, communities of color in Portland and beyond Portland. It was very bittersweet and difficult a little bit to hear her voice.
Yeah, Afifa. She was one of the first people I knew at KBOO, actually. Mm-hmm. It was nice and a little sad to hear her voice, but I'm glad that we have her there.
Mm-hmm. And I guess for me, just to add, you know, to echo those sentiments, but at the same time, when we didn't, you know, the folks that put together the proposal, we didn't have radio experience. Thank goodness for Afifa. We didn't have the engineering experience. And just to share a more, I guess, you know, a fond memory is just she took a look at our first run sheet. She just kind of, like, clearly you don't have radio experience.
Was it five pages long?
From an engineering perspective. And I think, you know, just she was so patient with us and learned a lot from her. But, yeah. You know, anyone else would have been like, okay, no. So just very grateful to have had the opportunity to work with her and get to know her.
And also, I just... thinking about, you know, it's been 10 years and I was there for, like, you know, I was sort of this one cohort of people. There was about three of us that came on at that time when I came on. And then, you know, Sarika and Andrew and Kushlani kind of have were sort of the latter part of the collective. But there's been so many people.
Right. There have been a lot of people.
So many people that have been part of the collective over the years. I mean, do we even know how many? It's probably been...
Well, so there has been Patty Duncan.
Who was my first interview for the APA Compass Collective, by the way.
And, of course, Pam Fawn, Josie Margolis Michael.
These are the founders.
Yeah, Wesley Wong.
Claire Olivera.
That's right. Lots of people who have, done APA Angry APA Minutes throughout the years.
In the latter years, we had Luann Algoso and Kahir and Anna Preble. It's funny just how many people have been. What was really funny is if I would run into some folks at an event or something and they would say, oh, you're with APA Compass. I was with them, 7 years ago. I would have no idea, just the way our paths crossed. It was funny.
I think that also is just a testament to that this was a really good idea and that people believed in it and that it could outlive in the ways, the founders could let it go and it could still exist. I mean, I think that's pretty amazing.
And I guess, go ahead, Patty.
I guess for me too, before we run out of time, I just want to make a plug to, by all means, even though in its old incarnation, APA Compass is sunsetting, I would strongly encourage folks, there is still such a need. And I think the idea of community radio, I think there's so much emphasis on new media and other, which are very important, but there's something to be said about, being able to just to turn on a radio, right? And kind of, for lack of a better word, kind of old school media frameworks, but are still so impactful. And I think issues around access and accessibility. So, gosh, if you have any interest in radio production, media production, you know, again, there's still a need, and just would strongly encourage. We need more voices out there still.
KBOO is available to everyone. Come walk right in. And
all day, every day.
Talk right. to Ani Haynes and start volunteering. And
And actually, that's something I want to say. You know, we're going to embark on this spring membership drive starting next week. So again, I want to say thank you to KBOO Community Radio for supporting our collective and believing in
thank
us
you,
and
KBOO.
Training us.
Yay.
It's such an incredible resource to bring our community's voices to the airwaves. And 10 years. So thank you so much to Tony, Marie, Patty, and Liz from the Air Room, who's been, you know, knocking it down left and right. And thank you to all of our collective members from over the years who've contributed their time and talent and their passion. And boy, thank you, KBOO listeners, for your support over the past 10 years.
Yes,
I've been hearing
thank you.
More as we're ending. I've been hearing more comments from people. Oh, no. But don't leave me, KBOO. Come join me at Intersections starting Friday, July 3rd. We're off for June, so we're going to start July 3rd at 9 a.m., still first Fridays. And that's it. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Farewell, APA Compass.
Yeah. You've been listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
And it is almost a minute past 10 a.m., and of course, you are listening to KBOO.